This is a CBC podcast.
Hi there, I'm David Cochran, and this is the Power and Politics podcast for Wednesday, April 17th. Lots of reaction to the federal budget today. Just ahead, the Minister of Small Business on the big tax changes announced in the spending plan, and the Power Panel with their take on the government's economic outlook. Plus, an extremely rare moment in Canadian politics as an arrived can contractor is admonished by the House of Commons. What did we learn after MPs grilled him on the floor of the House? We're going to move now to our continuing coverage of the Liberal government's latest budget and how it intends to pay for the $53 billion in new promises. Canada's wealthiest individuals and corporations will soon pay taxes on a larger share of the capital gains they earn, like the profits from the sale of stocks or an income property.
We don't think it's fair that a teacher or electrician pays taxes on 100% of their income, while a multimillionaire pays taxes only on 50% of the passive income they make on capital gains. So we're going to make them pay a little more.
But business groups aren't happy about that. According to the Business Council of Canada, the government is punishing the investors it relies on to generate growth. That means fewer good-paying jobs for Canadians. The Canadian Chamber of Commerce says throttling the success of Canadian businesses with new taxes will limit opportunities and employment for Canadians. And the Canadian Federation of Independent Business says the capital gains tax increase has the potential to demotivate Canadians from getting into business in the first place. Here to respond is the Minister of Small Business, Richie Valdez. Minister, it's good to see you. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you so much for having me, David.
You heard the reviews of the budget there from some of the biggest business groups in the country. They don't like what you're doing on taxes. How do you respond?
Well, first and foremost, I just want to say that 99.8% of Canadians will not be impacted by these changes. Again, as you heard the Prime Minister say, said earlier, it's really the ultra-wealthy that will be paying additional taxes or a little bit more. And really, the whole reason why we're doing this is because we're trying to create fairness for every generation, whether you're someone who's trying to look to purchase your very first home or whether you're an entrepreneur that's wanting to start your business. It's really creating that fairness for every generation, and particularly those who are young Gen X and millennials.
99.87% of Canadians may not be affected directly because they may not have capital gains in excess of $250,000, but they do work for companies who will be affected directly by this. And the consensus from a lot of the business analysts and lobby groups is that it's going to limit investment and maybe limit employment, which obviously would affect Canadians.
Well, what we've done in Budget 2024 is we've actually increased the lifetime capital gains exemption from $1 million to $1.25 million, and that is actually going to really help a small and medium-sized enterprise benefit from that exemption. And also, we also created a Canada entrepreneurial incentive, and that's really to help increase. So for Canadian entrepreneurs in the innovation and productivity sectors, they will get an additional $2 million dollars there of an exemption at an inclusion rate of 33.3%.
But if capital is now going to be taxed at a higher rate, and the people who have the capital and make their living and make their profits from the capital say it's a disincentive to investment, I mean, what kind of analysis do you have that that isn't the case, that this will not have a dampening effect on economic activity, productivity, and employment in the country?
Well, what I can say is if we compare Canada to the U.S., in Canada, we have a tax environment that is very competitive compared to the U.S., and even better than New York and in California. Here, again, through our incentive, it's really there to increase and encourage innovation through entrepreneurs, and again, through the lifetime capital gains exemption, and increasing that from $1 million to $1.25 million, it will certainly help with that.
When you just look at the rates, yes, it's arguably competitive with the United States, but they have a whole suite of deductions available to them in the U.S. Corporations in particular do that aren't necessarily available in Canada. The government here anticipates an additional $6.7 billion in taxes from this in the current fiscal year, but that hinges on your ability to collect it, that this doesn't cause a change in behavior, and the people with the means to have this kind of wealth don't engage in tax avoidance.
Well, one of the things that we've also introduced through Budget 2024, which I'm particularly proud of, is our investments. That's $2 billion in artificial intelligence. As I've met with many small businesses across the country, they've asked us to ensure that we're looking forward to how do we help small business pivot in a world where we're moving towards artificial intelligence. And these investments, and in particular $200 million dedicated to helping AI startups, will certainly help with this regard in terms of investment. And in terms of what our government has done, we've also leveled the playing field for women entrepreneurs. We've invested $7 billion into our women entrepreneurship strategy, our Black Entrepreneurship Program. And really, by leveling the playing field, what we're doing is we're creating an environment where everyone can succeed. And the one thing I'm very proud of, being an entrepreneur myself, is through Futurepreneur in our Budget 2024, we're putting forward an investment of $60 million to Futurepreneur, and that's going to benefit entrepreneurs age 18 to 39.
Right, but how do you ensure these new measures don't lead to tax avoidance, people looking at other ways, or maybe even taking investments and making them or moving them outside of the country? Because often the wealthiest people are the ones with the means to take these sorts of measures. They're the hardest people to get the extra cash from. And when you're talking about capital gains and people with this level of wealth, and corporations in particular, how do you ensure you're actually able to collect that cash?
Well, what I can say in the U.S., if you compare us just to our folks in the South, is they're being taxed on 100% of their capital gains. Where again, here, through our lifetime capital gains and exemption, we've increased that from $1 million to $1.25 million. We've had the additional incentive for Canadian entrepreneurs, and that will certainly help it because the inclusion rate there is 33.3%.
Right. So the Canadian Federation of Independent Business has said that the entrepreneur incentive picks winners and losers, and it creates an uneven playing field simply because of the sector you're in. So that a company involved in the innovation sector will qualify for this, but someone in a more traditional industry wouldn't, and you're creating an uneven tax measure there that punishes people who are in traditional industries. How do you respond?
That particular incentive is focused to spur innovation and productivity, but there's so many other investments that we've made through our government, whether that's our global innovation clusters that have helped different industries, whether that's our agriculture industry or pharma care industry. We've had several investments, not just the ones that you see in Budget 2024, and we will continue to invest in small and medium-sized businesses across the country.
There has been some pushback that this could affect family doctors and other professionals who incorporate their practice for the tax advantages that a corporation would have. So while individually, if they were, say, working in a hospital, they would not necessarily be affected by the new capital gains inclusion, but if their corporate structure is such that they're relying on corporate investments to pay for their future and their retirement, they're going to be hit. And that in a country that's already struggling to have enough family doctors, this creates a disincentive for some of them to work in Canada.
We recognize that, but one of the things that we will continue to do is encourage foreign credential recognition to help. We know that coming out of the pandemic, our healthcare has really been hampered, and there's a really challenge with labor. But the investments we made with foreign credentialing, we've already made a significant investment in previous budgets, and in this year we've topped that up, and we will continue to invest to ensure we're encouraging bringing talent from other countries to get their credentials recognized, mm-hmm. and that will also encourage them to get more jobs here and fill the desperate labor market needs that are required in our healthcare industry.
No, and I understand the impetus to try to accelerate health professionals in particular to be able to work in Canada through the standard. But if doctors who are here now, who are set up through the existing corporate structure that relies heavily on capital gains income for their retirement and for their future because they wouldn't have a pension in this sort of a situation, if they balk at the situation that has been created by this change, I mean, how do you deal with that? The goal is to not increase the gap in medical coverage, right? So how do you respond to the concerns being raised by people in that sector that this is potentially punitive to them?
If I take a step back to what I mentioned earlier, and you heard the Prime Minister said it, what we're really trying to do is really create a Canada that is fair for every generation. If we think about all the benefits that will help for young Gen Z millennials, right now, it feels like the challenges are stacked up against them. We're trying to give them a better future for them to feel encouraged, whether that's to buy their first home, start their family, just like I did once upon a time. We really want to create an environment that will help them. So yes, while we are, the ones that are being taxed are the ultra wealthy, at the end of the day, what we're ultimately trying to do is make a more fairer Canada, and especially those who are young millennials and Gen Zs.
There has been some reaction from people who have worked on federal budgets in the past. David Dodge, a former governor of the Bank of Canada, former deputy minister of finance, he said he was concerned that this budget would take the country in the wrong direction. And he says, since the details have come out, I have these concerns now, knowing what precisely is in the budget. He told the Wall Street Journal. And David Rosenberg, who's a well-known financial analyst, says this is among the more misguided budgets that we've seen in Canada. They don't like the increasing high level of spending. They don't like the capital gains tax. What do you say to these people who have the ear of the investment community and have the ear of Bay Street?
Well, what it comes down to is what Canada needs right now is more homes to be built and faster. We are definitely focused on that. We're helping to build and drive an economy, and we believe in investing in Canadians, whether that's entrepreneurs or helping invest in families, in seniors, through our different initiatives, whether that's $10 a day childcare to help benefit women. In fact, more women have entered the workforce than ever before. That's more women contributing to the larger economy, and that's even helping them start their very first business. We're building more homes faster, building the economy and strengthening it, and we believe in always investing in Canadians and not just cutting things or cutting programs and cutting back, because we believe that Canadians deserve to be invested in.
But do you think there's enough here? I mean, you're the Minister of Small Business. Do you think there's enough here on growth, on productivity? Because the business community is kind of outside of specific things like AI and the investment tax credits, which target key industries to your industrial policy. They say broadly, there's nothing there that can be globally applied to help all companies scale up and grow and get more productive.
I've mentioned already all the different investments we've made already to really drive inclusive entrepreneurship. We believe that, again, by including more people and making it a more inclusive environment through our women entrepreneurship strategy, that is going to encourage $150 billion just by that one investment alone in women entrepreneurs. That's just one example where we're going to continue to invest in Canadians and supporting entrepreneurs.
Okay, one last thing. Your government has said it will urgently return more than $2.5 billion in long-awaited carbon tax rebates to about 600,000 small and medium-sized businesses. This is something they've been waiting for years. Can you give us a sense about the size, the scope, and the timing of those benefits? Because there's a lot of small businesses who have been waiting for this, and they don't quite know what to expect.
That's a great question. So through our budget 2024, the size of it is we're looking at $2.5 billion. Mm-hmm. That'll be going and flowing back to approximately 600,000 SMEs across the country. I encourage SMEs to file their taxes for 2023 by July 15, 2024. And as long as you do so and you're a corporation that has less than 499 employees, you will be able to receive the Canada Carbon Rebate.
Does every business get the same, like every household gets the same on the individual carbon rebate, or does the size of it depend on the scope and scale of the business, or is it just a flat amount?
Once we have those details, we'll be able to send it out to SMEs across the country.
Okay. Richie Valdez, Minister of Small Business, thank you for your time today.
Thank you.
An extraordinary event unfolding in the House of Commons. It's something that has not happened since 1913. GC Strategies partner Christiane Firth, a key player in the Arrivcan controversy, is admonished by the Speaker.
On behalf of the House of Commons, I admonish you.
Firth was called to the House today after being found in contempt of Parliament when he failed to answer questions before a committee looking into the Arrivcan app. GC Strategies, a two-person IT staffing firm, was the largest contractor hired to work on the app, but it was later found out that it had subcontracted that work out to six other companies. We now know GC Strategies made more than $11 million for its work. The CBC's Karina Roman has been following this for us today, and she joins me now. And Karina, before this even started today, the questioning by the MPs was the rare thing. We learned that First House was raided in connection to an RCMP investigation into alleged misconduct in an outsourced Canadian Border Services Agency contract. Just listen to this clip.
Terminate. Today, media reports that Mr. Firth's property was raided by the Royal Canadian Mounted Police. What crime are they investigating?
Mr. Firth.
Mr. Speaker, that's correct. There was a search warrant, not an arrest warrant, for my property to obtain electronic goods surrounding the Butler allegations.
Okay, so Karina, we know the founders of Botler alerted the CBSA of this alleged subcontracting misconduct. What more did we learn about all of this in the testimony so far?
Well, he was asked repeatedly, first of all, whether he knows what the RCMP took. I mean, the warrant was for electronic devices, you heard there. He said he didn't know because he wasn't there at the time when the warrant was executed. So we don't have a clear answer on what they actually took away. He was asked if he'd seen the warrant, and he said he's skimmed it, but he couldn't go into detail in accuracy off the top of his head. Just the fact that he confirmed it happened, but they tried to clarify whether or not it's about, like, actually the ArriveCan app, or, as he said there, the Botler allegations. The Botler allegations are about improper contracting, including GC strategies, but not particularly about the ArriveCan app, and that's where he said the search, that's what it was about. So that's the additional detail we got from him in testimony, and that's, so far, questions have not continued in that vein. They've been on other things.
Okay, this is still happening in the House of Commons as we speak, but, you know, Karina, when this all started, there was an attempt by the Liberals to shut this whole line of questioning down today. What happened there?
So Steve McKinnon, the House leader for the government, stood up when his questioning, the Liberals were given the first 10 minutes of questioning, to point out that and ask questions about the consultation that Mr. Firth had with a medical doctor about his ability to essentially go through a situation like this that's going to cause him stress and perhaps, you know, mental health problems or exacerbate mental health problems that he's dealing with, and that he said he's taking medication for and taking therapy for. So he corroborated that, yes, he'd met with a doctor and there was an actual note recommending against an event such as this. Then led to Steve McKinnon using the opportunity to say that it meant that the Liberals certainly did not, that side of the House did not want to engage further until, you know, he's more medically ready to deal with this, and took a dig at the opposition to say, you know, what does that say about you that you want to? Of course, the opposition took issue with that. The Liberals, therefore, have not participated in the questioning, but the other parties have. And he has taken pauses and breaks and been asked if he'd like them, but it did end up proceeding, yes.
Okay, it's an interesting choice because, as you can see on the screen, there's Blake Desjarlais, is an NDP MP. The Liberals have essentially ceded the floor to the opposition on this, and it is continuing and will go on for some time. So what stood out to you, Karina, from what we've heard to this point so far?
So there has been some substance, although some of the substance is really those details that MPs certainly want to know, but I'm not sure the average Canadian cares about the names of the people that they're looking for. But we have now been given the names of, for instance, the person he talked to, the public servant he talked to in helping create the criteria for the very contract that then they won, which of course has been part of the controversy. The nature of the out-of-work engagement and meetings he had with, for instance, former chief information officers with the government, and how appropriate that was, and whether it was, he characterizes it as a health check on existing contracts, not about getting new contracts. He tried to clear up contradictions and clarifications, but he did admit basically that in his previous appearance at committee, that not only did he not answer things properly, but, you know, he actually also answered things untruthfully. And so that stood out to me for sure. And that he would do it differently now that he's been admonished and is making history in a way that I'm not sure anyone wants their name to go down in the history books for this. We have learned a little bit about how contracting works from his perspective, but also in the nature of the questions that we've heard from the MPs. He was also asked, David, whether or not the government has asked for any money back, seeing as, you know, there's lots of questions about whether value for money, an $80,000 contract ballooning to what the Auditor General can sort of guess to be about $60 million. He says he has not been asked for the money back. So he was also asked, whether he would give the money back, whether he should just do it regardless of being asked for it. And he defended the work that his company did and went through, you know, what he was asked to do, what he was required to do, and then he did that all. And so he didn't answer the question directly, but you got a sense that he doesn't feel he should be giving that money back. And I just want to say there has been, as you know, a bit of drama, as we talked about. And there certainly was a lot of back and forth and some posturing in addition to actual questions that have been meaningful. But one question from the Conservatives, from Larry Brock, was insinuating that he's taking the fall for the government and for the Prime Minister and for Cabinet Ministers, and whether he's willing to go to jail for them. So that was a bit of a moment, which he declined to answer because he pointed out that that question is speculation and not one he can really answer.
Okay, Karina, thank you so much. This is CBC's Karina Roman. We're going to continue to monitor this and bring you any major developments. The Liberal government laid out $53 billion in new spending in yesterday's budget, money for everything from housing projects to carbon tax rebates for small businesses. All of that rolling out over the next 5 years. But the opposition had a different view on how Canada should manage its books.
He's paying off the ultra-wealthy by spending $54 billion on debt interest more than on health care. Why give more money to the ultra-wealthy bankers and bondholders instead of the nurses and doctors?
Yeah. Will the Liberals take on corporate greed, which is driving up the cost of living?
We are asking for the wealthiest in this country, the wealthiest 0.1%, to pay more in taxes so we can support the middle class, so we can restore the dream, particularly for young people.
All right, there's a lot to dig into still from yesterday's budget. We're going to bring in the power panel to do some of that. Amanda Olivero is a former Liberal Party communication strategist. Here with me in the studio, Tim Powers, former strategist for Conservative parties. Jordan Leichnitz is a former NDP strategist. And Sherelle Evelyn is the managing editor of The Hill Times. Good to see you all, gang. Happy day after budget. Amanda, not too happy, though, for the business community of Canada, who is railing against the capital gain inclusion rate increase. And we've heard David Dodge and people like David Rosenberg saying this puts us in the wrong direction, and they're pointing to the deficit and the debt servicing costs. What do you make of that blowback from the business community?
Yeah, I don't know that I would say from the business community. I think that there were, you know, some economists whom you've mentioned, and there were others who had a different point of view and a different take on it. And I think that there's a lot of people in the business community, many of whom I spoke today, who actually talked about it being really good policy. I mean, this is taking, as the Prime Minister you just saw in the clip, 0.13% of the population in Canada. 40,000 people will pay a little more, so 99.87% of Canadians don't have to pay a cent more. And this is about services in the end. These are the things that the opposition parties have been asking for, right? Even Poilievre, when you look at his desire to address the housing crisis, this is about addressing the housing crisis, about more childcare spaces. It's about the disability benefit. It's about nutrition programs in schools. When I hear Poilievre in particular talk about the debt and talk about the spend, the first question that always comes to my mind is, what exactly would you cut? The childcare spaces, pharmacare, free contraception for women, nutrition programs for kids, housing? Like, what is it that you would take off the table, and who would you give it to? So I thought overall, my impression and my take of it was that this was good policy to address some of the critical needs that Canadians are facing right now.
Well, we don't know exactly what his fiscal plan would be, Tim. We know the CBC would be cut by a Conservative government, so that's the one definite answer that we have. And
screw up your capital. Right,
exactly. Right. But on that, you know, Amanda's point, only 0.13% of Canadians are going to pay the capital gains increase, but 100% of companies will. And this is the argument coming back from the CFIB, Chamber of Commerce, mm-hmm. Business Council of Canada, and you're even hearing it from people in the medical profession, doctors' offices that incorporate as a corporation for the tax benefits are now going to be hit by this. I mean, what do you mean? Is there a consequence?
I think the number they had there, which is different, so Amanda rightly says the 40,000, mm-hmm. But then there are 307,000 corporations. There are lots of people mm-hmm. who aren't uber wealthy, who aren't flying to Davos in private jets, who run small businesses, who could be impacted by this. Look, to be fair to the government, they increased the threshold
exemption
from 1 million to 1.25 million. But, you know, I don't think that offsets the concern that is there. I think it also gets back to being a bit of a messaging challenge, which the government is trying to fix today. You've seen people associated with the government trying to put out more details of who precisely these 40,000 people are to get away from people thinking it'll be them, turning this into what 2017 was. And we'll remember in 2017, there was a revolt in the Liberal caucus when then Finance Minister Bill Morneau looked at taxing personal corporations. Now, if you're a doctor, you're a lawyer, you're a convenience store owner, you're a farmer, you probably have a personal corporation because guess what? Most people don't have a lot of pensions. Mm-hmm. It's interesting, though, watching the politicians play this. Pierre Poilievre has not got sucked into this yet. And that's a deliberate trap that's being set by the government for him of defending, you know, the uber wealthy who are the 40,000 that the Liberals want you to focus on.
Well, we heard him go after the uber wealthy.
Yeah, I mean, listen, you make money in Canada, you're the biggest friggin' pinata, and everybody wants to whack you at the moment. That's not just in Canada, that's around the world. The danger, though, with this policy is if you step back from the rhetoric, there's a degree of evidence which does suggest that capital takes flight. Innovators do move. And whether we want to accept the reality of it or not, that you know, we should pay for services, we should do all of those things, but some of the people who create wealth, who have money or are small businesses, do get put off, do feel penalized, do feel that their power is taken away from them and they pay more and they don't have pensions.
I should point out, though, that the Canadian Federation of Independent Businesses say their early assessment is that most small businesses come out ahead or be unaffected by the changes because of the boost in that lifetime capital gains exemption that Tim mentioned. So I don't want you to think everybody says it's doom and gloom, but there is a concern, Jordan, that this attempt at fairness for every generation that the Liberals have engaged in by sort of spending the economic windfall and the new tax revenue is also going to leave a bigger debt and bigger debt servicing costs for the generation they're trying to help. What do you think of the balance they've tried to strike here?
Well, I think there's no question. It's a tough one. And they've come up on the political level with a typically liberal response, which is that they are going to please no one. And so today you hear the complaints from the business community and from others about the capital gains change, which I think we should point out that many economists actually point out is very modest and very surgical in terms of
unless
what
it does.
Unless
you got to pay it.
Well, that's
Tim's
a very,
this personal,
a very small and a very expensive violin that Tim's playing there. And so, but then on the other hand, you've got a lot of progressives who are really concerned about rising inequality in Canada, about corporate profiteering, that we know this is a huge issue. We've seen this particularly when it comes to food prices. And that is something that they left relatively unaddressed in the budget. Mm. And so I think that they have a real political challenge here in that what they put forward, and this is, I think, maybe the only thing that Tim got right in the analysis, is that the Conservatives didn't take the bait. It wasn't big enough to provoke a fight. And so that leaves them, I think, not in the best position, because really what they needed to have happen for this to be a success on budget day was for Poilievre to get into a fight and be cornered into defending the wealthiest and the people who would be impacted by this tax change. And he really hasn't done that.
Yeah, they didn't move on food really, Sherelle, because like when they sort of made the promises to do that, it was running much higher than headline inflation. And now we're a couple of months into food prices seem to have largely kind of stabilized and running lower than headline inflation. Still up, but like it's not the runaway numbers we've seen. I mean, where do you think the government is after this? They had the big communications rollout leading up to this. Where are they the day after?
I'm still trying to figure that out because I was saying earlier, okay, let's look at, say, take me, for example. I probably fall into that demographic that the Liberals are trying to get back at or to win back.
Right.
You know, I'm a woman, I'm a black, I'm, you know, a millennial, somebody who is not a homeowner, but would maybe one day want to be, all of those things. So if I'm looking at this budget and I'm going, okay, win me over, I don't know if I've seen it. So all of the things that they rolled out ahead of time, there, you know, there's the big push on housing, big push on AI, they pushed on their defense spending, things like that. When you actually get the budget in your hands and read through it, which I unfortunately had to do, you get to the things that are saying, okay, but what is going to help me today? Mm-hmm. And you're not really seeing anything. There's a whole chapter on, doing things for the cost of living. And the majority of it was just things that had already been announced. You know, it was harkening back to, you know, that grocery rebate from last year and tackling junk fees, which they talked about last year. And I really think that some of the only things that were in there in terms of new measures were there was very, very little. There was something like, okay, we're going to tell, we're going to change the Telecommunications Act so that the CRTC can ban carriers from charging you if you want to switch providers.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah, the big the big picture stuff, the demographic, the mortgage class and those working hard to join it, you know, to update the mantra. The supply challenges are going to take a long time.
A long time.
Though, to their credit, there was a whole inventory of government lands that they're putting up right away. So it's not just we're going to study and do things. It's like, you know, if you want to live above the Canada Post, here you go, right?
But they still have to build it.
Yeah. Well, this is the labor supply constraints are still the challenge.
They still have to build it. They still have to figure out who's, they have to figure out the structure for that. They're going to figure out how are we going to structure these long-term leases? Who's going to actually, you know, be the developers who are going to take those on? And then. I saw one date in there. There was talk about hitting those targets for 2031, but then there's further targets for things like occupancy by 2036. Like, that's a long time from now. And anybody who's looking to make, do something, you know, solid with their lives right now or in the next, say, 5 years, I don't know if this particular budget was enough for the Liberals to point to for the next election, because let's face it, if we have another election, they're going to have what, maybe one more budget, and that's not going to be, you know, really worth much the paper that it's printed on at that point in the mandate when you're only a few months out from an election. So this would have been, had to have been it. This is what they have to work with. And I don't know if it was a big enough swing.
So Amanda, one of the things that came up again and again and again yesterday as you're asking people for their assessment of this is that the aspiration is fine, but the challenge for this government has often been execution. That, for example, even in budget 2024, the investment tax credits announced in 2022 are still not finalized and completely defined. And now there's this ambitious plan to build 4 million housing units of some form in 6-7 years. And that is, they don't control all the levers to do that, and they don't necessarily have the workforce to do that.
So much doom and gloom today.
Or reality.
Bring a little sunshine to this conversation.
Okay, sunny ways. Yep.
There is so much to celebrate here. I talked to a big group of young moms
on the
today.
The carbon tax in particular.
And there are real things. The Prime Minister.
Hang on a second. Sorry, Amanda. We just accidentally played a clip of Andrew Fury. Preview. We're going to talk about him next. But go ahead. Finish your point. Sorry about that.
He like rained on my sunshine. It's fine. But here's the thing. Look, for people who are either struggling with grocery prices, there are 400,000 kids who are going to have nutritious meals, and those are happening. There's more childcare spaces, more daycare spaces. Those are happening. $10 a day childcare is happening. The fact that we're going to roll out the first tranche of PharmaCare is not 10 years down the road. It is now. And it means free contraception for women. Any woman who's watching this should be celebrating that right now. Housing, well, obviously it takes time to build. They're still doing things in the budget that are going to affect people today. Things like looking at 30-year mortgages for first-time home buyers, or looking at renter protections, or putting up the public lands, as you've said. I mean, there's only so much that a government can do to switch, you know, lights on a moment's notice. But I actually think that there's a ton of meat in this budget. The fact that the carbon rebate is coming back to small businesses, and it's coming back urgently, was the word used. I mean, these are very tangible examples of things that are happening that families will feel in their pocketbooks or in their homes, or small businesses will feel in their bank accounts right away. I think that there's a lot to celebrate here.
Okay, I'm not trying to be all doom and gloom. I'm just trying to point out that these are the challenges of government.
I'll give you a fog bank. Cochrane to back you up. I mean, I love Amanda's enthusiasm and energy, and the government needs more of that if they're going to convince people. But the problem is convincing them. So they've got a few challenges. 8 years, they've talked about housing for a while. Now this is going to make the difference. I mean, that's a legitimate question to ask. People can be excited. And I know some people are. For certain they are. But it hasn't happened yet. Why is it going to happen now? The second point on all of this is there are real challenges. Yeah, there's money there for housing. But back to the point we were making a moment ago. Try and find the labor to do it.
Yeah, that's going to be a big challenge.
Try and get it done. So which you need political credibility here. And I will just tell you what the polling data has shown so far, at least our stuff as of last week, when most of this stuff was there. The only thing that wasn't being talked about last week was the capital gains measure. The Liberals were still 20 points behind. Mm-hmm. 20 points behind. I don't know it. The last point I'll make, does the messenger have the credibility? I mean, this isn't 2015 sunny ways and all of that. He's been in power for a while. He certainly had political successes, but it's wearing on him, and the Canadian public have not shown anything in the last 6 months that they're prepared to believe the Prime Minister and or the Finance Minister, so it's a tough battle for them.
Okay, speaking of fog, I want to switch to some political news outside of Ottawa from mine and Tim's home province in Newfoundland and Labrador, and this is where the Liberal government lost a seat previously held by a cabinet minister in Fogo Island to the Progressive Conservatives in a by-election, and they got thumped pretty good. It was almost 1,000 votes, which is big in a by-election in that province, and Liberal Premier Andrew Fury laid part of that blame on the federal carbon tax. Just listen to this.
On the carbon tax in particular, the Prime Minister has tried to bait me at times with certain ad hominems and name-calling almost. We have a very different opinion on the carbon tax. It's not right for the people of the province. Right now, given the inflationary pressures, given the indirect costs, I wish the Prime Minister would understand that. He's being very sclerotic in his approach on this ideologic marriage that he has to this principle. That's not to say that we don't believe in fighting climate change. We certainly do, but this policy is wrong.
Okay, Jordan, that's about as angry as I've seen Andrew Fury get, you know, in an understated way. But the Prime Minister tried to bait me. He's being sclerotic and stubborn on this. You know, when you're trying to change the channel with a budget, dealing with a bunch of progressive ideas, the other Liberal First Minister at the provincial level comes back with this.
It's not great. It's not what you want to see. And I was really struck by the personal nature of the comments, actually. I think that's the first time we've really seen the Premier poking back at the Prime Minister personally. And I do think that, you know, he does have a point in the sense that the Liberals are very wedded to this one particular policy in terms of a means of reducing emissions. And it's incredibly unpopular in Atlantic Canada. Mm-hmm. And so, of course, I think it probably did play a factor in the by-election. Now, if I had also just lost a by-election in a very embarrassing manner, I'd also be looking for external things to blame. So I think that that's also got to be always part of the story when we look at some of those comments. But I do think that it's unhelpful to the federal Liberals, this kind of fighting from a Liberal Premier. And it's notable that the comments are getting sharper.
Yeah, and sure, look, for people who don't know Newfoundland politics super well, by-elections in the spring are always tough. The fishery's often in crisis. Right. That was the case. And Fogo, that Fogo Cape Friels, as it's now called, the fishery matters in that part of the country. But here we have Sherelle. It is an escalation there. Like, Fury seems to be... He isn't just a Liberal Premier. He's, like, chaired the federal Liberal election efforts in that province in the past and was part of Trudeau's leadership campaign.
I mean, that's all true. And, of course, you know, he's getting the pushback from his own residents and constituents about cost of living and how they feel that the price on carbon plays into that. Mm. I noticed it didn't really play a big role when they won a seat in the by-election earlier in the year. So, you know, swings and roundabouts, I suppose. Mm. But, you know, I know it sounded earlier, and I was, that I was crapping a bit on the budget. But, you know, to its credit, there was something in there which you don't typically see too often. And there was an actual really decent breakdown of, okay, when it comes to emissions and the pricing and what this is actually going to cost. Mm-hmm. I don't have the numbers in front of me right now, but they did say, you know, low emissions, high emissions, kind of doing nothing. These are some of the numbers attached to that, and here's where we're actually going, and here's the benchmarks that we're going to be hitting with the price on carbon. What we're not hearing from, you know, Anthony Fury and all these other premiers who...
Andrew Fury. Andrew Fury.
Sorry. So sorry.
Yeah. Very different guys. Very different Furies. Yeah.
Very different Furies. Andrew Fury. Thank you for correcting me.
You may not be allowed in Newfoundland.
I haven't been yet. Can't close the door on me.
Yours to discover.
Oh, no, that's Ontario.
So what we haven't been hearing from kind of from everybody is what they want to do outside of the carbon price.
Yeah, absolutely.
And we haven't yet heard you know, what steps are they going to take? And everybody wants to say the cost of living is high. Absolutely. This is a bad policy because it, you know, it has an impact on the cost of living. Okay. But what about the price of doing nothing? What about the price of climate change? And we haven't heard that yet. And so until we can actually hear something definitive, you kind of can understand almost why the Prime Minister is so rigid with his attachment to this policy.
Yeah, and I think the Parliamentary Budget Officer could do the country a great service if he updated the analysis that he did and put in these other scenarios so you can get an apples-to-apples comparison. And you know, Amanda, not to be all doom and gloom again, but this is not the sort of thing they wanted to have coming out of the budget launch after what was a pretty successful communication strategy by a lot of accounts leading up to this, to have this being resurrected and sort of, you know, the loss of a rural Atlantic Canadian seat by the Liberals, which is a big fear, at least for your party, being laid at the feet of their signature environmental policy like this.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm still sort of stuck on the fact that he used the word sclerotic.
He's an orthopedic surgeon, right? He's medical jargon is part of his jam.
Amazing. But probably not the best word to use when you're trying to talk to like a mass population. And the challenge with the way that he communicates, and the advice that I would give to him if he was watching right now and wanted some, was instead of playing sour grapes because you just lost a by-election that you should have won, why don't you spend the time really communicating to the residents of the province about, instead of using sort of the lazy conservative rhetoric that this is just bad and this is costly, why don't you talk about the rebates? Why don't you talk about what this actually looks like in pocketbooks? Why don't you talk about the fact that most Canadians will be better off when those rebates come in than they were before? And then why don't you talk about what it means if we do nothing, as Sherelle has said? And so to me, it's just, you know, it's a little unfortunate to hear that kind of rhetoric from him, but it just feels a bit lazy. And I'm not sure that anyone watching is thinking to themselves, oh, you know, like that was the big dent on budget day. He just sat and did a little sour grapes.
Tim, quick thoughts.
Well, first of all, there's a very tight line between the federal Liberals and the provincial Liberals in Atlantic Canada, as you and I know, and the rest of the panel knows. The Premier Fury, by his own admission, is suffering because the Prime Minister is down. The Prime Minister floated all boats in 2015. He's sinking them right now. The reason Andrew Fury wisely is not pushing the carbon rebate is he'd get thrown in St. John's Harbour if he did. Because as
I'm also not sure he just believes in it.
Well, you know, I think there are two differences there. I do think he does. I think he has a very different view. He believes in climate change, but I don't think he sees the practicality of the policy in Atlantic Canada. And secondarily, he is trying to make separation between himself and the federal Liberals. He may call an election in the fall. He wants to get out ahead of the Prime Minister. And he, certainly in Newfoundland and Labrador, the most unpopular political figure is the Prime Minister, fairly or unfairly. That is the case. And it's just good politics to do what he's doing right now. His opponents are trying to tie them together. And he was, I think, the first premier, to be fair to him, who put out a letter saying, let's do a first minister's meeting and look at alternative approaches. So as Amanda's advice, I'm sure, would normally be appreciated, I'm not sure he's going to be charging around the province saying, rebate, 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 and love me for it. Not going to happen.
Okay, quick thought on that?
Yeah, I'm really struck in the difference in his response to what we're seeing from Premier Canoe in Manitoba, because I think it's an interesting example. There you have another premier who is in a province where the carbon tax is incredibly unpopular, trying to break away from that policy. But the difference there is that Premier Canoe is actually, he's taking up the challenge of creating a made in Manitoba solution on emissions. And actually, I think it's important to remember, like, that was the purpose of the federal backstop. Like, it's not that the federal plan was to have every province on this. It's only if provinces choose not to create their own systems that meet that level of ambition.
No, but the system has to have a price on carbon. And I don't know if Wab Canoe is going to do that, because it sounds like he's not, unless he moves to some sort of cap and trade system.
Well, we're going to see. We're going to see. But, you know, there are different ways to meet those emissions goals, and I think that that's probably a more productive place to push the conversation.
Okay. I do want to get quick thoughts on this, because something historic happened in Parliament today. For the first time since 1913, since before the First World War, MPs found a member of the public in contempt of Parliament and ordered him to face questions before the bar of the House. GC Strategy's head, Christian Firth, appeared before a House committee last fall over the company's part in the ArriveCan app controversy, and today Firth was admonished by the Speaker of the House.
You are attending the bar of the House for being found in contempt
for your refusal to answer certain questions and for prevaricating in your answers to other questions on behalf of the House of Commons. I admonish you.
Government MPs decided not to question Firth after he submitted a doctor's note saying he should not be put in overly stressful positions due to mental health issues and criticized Conservatives for doing so.
The Leader of the Opposition is giving us a demonstration of his character, and Canadians should pay careful attention.
All right, that's what happened in the House. Sherelle, we also learned today that Mr. Firth's house was searched by the RCMP in a criminal investigation related to allegations from Butler AI, which is a Montreal tech firm, which has also been described as a whistleblower for complaining about cozy relations between consultants and improper subcontracting things, not necessarily connected to ArriveCamp, but part of that whole larger bundle of issues. What do you make of what we saw today and what we learned today?
Well, I don't know if we especially learned anything super new. There was a couple answers that Mr. Firth gave that, you know, he hadn't given before in terms of specific names. I do think it was probably a little bit more of a preventative measure to kind of or a cautionary tale to other people to say, hey, if you're thinking about being evasive at a House committee, you might want to think again because you'll get dragged in front of everybody. And this is, you know, it's kind of embarrassing for that to have to happen to you. In terms of the Liberals not questioning Mr. Firth instead and kind of walking away because of his doctor's note, I don't know if it was, you know, the big swing that maybe they were hoping it was, if they were kind of hoping for like a, oh, captain, my captain type of moment where everybody would kind of get up on the desk and say, yeah, you know what, this is wrong, and just kind of walk out.
Yeah.
That obviously didn't happen. And he handled himself, decently.
He got through it.
I'm sure it wasn't easy. But you know what? Those were some of the same considerations that had been made and some of the same excuses that had been made earlier on in the committee process. So I can understand why some of the MPs would be less willing to kind of give him that bit of grace, saying, you know what, we've tried this and we've gone through this for months and this is where we are today.
Amanda, what do you make of this decision to just cede the floor to the opposition parties by the Liberals on the basis of this doctor's note? I mean, I have no insight into Mr. Firth's medical conditions. I'm not casting any aspersions on the claims by his doctor, but it was going ahead anyway, and he handled the questions, and he had his lawyer there, and it just became all opposition, and is there just no upside for them, or what?
Yeah, I don't think there is a lot of upside, although I do think the decision was perplexing. I don't agree with Sherelle. I don't think it was supposed to be like this big moment that they were going to get credit for walking away from questioning because there was a doctor's note and there was a mental health issue. I think that that's, you know, probably a practical thing that one should do in the case of a doctor's note, but I don't think that they were looking for a lot of credit on that. I do think, though, ceding all the questions to the opposition, maybe not the best political decision, but it's not the worst either, because again, I don't think that there was a ton of upside for them in the House today anyway.
You know, Tim, it's good to see Parliament taking a firm stand against evasive and misleading and incomplete answers, just in general. I just wonder if how long that will last. But, you know, now that they've done this, and clearly they wanted to send a message to anybody who comes to committee, and Mr. Firth in particular, the RCMP is doing work.
Yeah.
So how do you balance this? I mean, the Evidence Act and parliamentary privilege intersect here in a way that, you know, I'm not going to pretend to explain, but you want to have a credible investigation into this, but there's also politics.
Look, I'm sure you and Downton Abbey fans were thrilled with the parliamentary admonishment because that's going to do so much. I don't want to comment on Mr. Firth's health.
Yeah.
That's his own personal matter. And to the Liberal strategy, I think Amanda spoke to it well. I think ultimately Canadians are going to look at what the police may or may not do here. Mm-hmm. And I think they will judge what has happened based on that. The political theater, albeit historic, will be parked on the side and become a side note. They'll see if whomever is brought to account, if there is a reason to bring them to account.
Jordan, where do you think we are on this as a final point?
Yeah, I would largely agree with Tim. I think that there's not a lot of evidence that Canadians are following the blow-by-blow of this story very closely. And although I agree that today, for procedural geeks, this is like peak content, it's a pretty narrow audience for that. And so the Conservatives, they were able to get some clips of the questioning in the House today, which I think for, you know, we know that for their social media strategy, That's always been really important, so it'll feed that beast a little bit. But I don't think at the end of the day it's going to have a whole lot of impact. I do think everything is really going to hinge on the criminal investigations here. But, you know, all of that said, every day that there is more news about problems, potential corruption, major, major irregularities in contracting under this Liberal government, it goes to competence, and it's a problem for them.
Yeah, his historic, you know, admonishment and police search home are, you know, things that go into a lead that a government...
Julian Fellows couldn't have written that into Downton Abbey.
All right. We got to leave it there. I got to watch more Downton Abbey, apparently. I want to thank the Power Panel. Amanda Alvaro, Tim Powers, Jordan Leichnitz, and Sherelle Evelyn. Thanks so much, gang. That's it for today. If you like this episode, please follow the pod and catch our next live show on CBC News Network. We're on weekdays at 5 p.m. Eastern Time. I'm David Cochrane. Thanks for listening.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.